And we'll begin with the Duane County School Board's decision this week to change the controversial name of Nathan Bedford Forrest High School. And by the way, if you'd like to call in, you can. The number, as always, is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. You can call in and give us your input. Forrest was named after a Confederate general and the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan back in the 1950s. A group called the Daughters of the Confederacy pushed for the name in what many see as a response to orders to desegregate Jacksonville schools. Students will now have a chance to pick the school's new name. The two frontrunners at the moment are Westside High School and Firestone High School. And our question to callers, what do you think of this decision to change the name? Give us a call at 549-2931. Now, we spoke with Duval County Public School Superintendent Dr. Nikolai Vitti about the decision after the meeting on Monday night. Here's what he had to say.
I think it restores faith in part of the community that maybe didn't always feel that we were equitable with our decisions.
And that's what the Dr. Vitti had to say about that. Gentlemen, how do we roll with this? Christopher, you cover these events on a regular basis. What's your feeling about what took place?
Well, it was clearly a response from the superintendent and the school board, because their thinking of it was that, you know, this is a topic that came up back in 2007 as well, and if they didn't change the name at this point, it was just going to keep coming up. And this is a board that on many occasions said that their main focus for these next few years is on student achievement, and they like to get away from things that distract from that. And they felt like to get this action done one way or the other quickly would get them back on the track of making decisions about teachers and students and particularly their achievement. When you look at the landscape of education in this state right now, they have many, many other things to be concerned about, particularly Common Core and some of the testing associated with that. So the naming of a school is something that the superintendent felt like he should have got done quickly and moved on. So that's what you're seeing here.
I think the thing that fascinates me the most about this isn't that it was done, but that it was done in a way so quickly after the last time it tried to be done and failed. And the idea that there's such a sea change in how the board viewed this. Last time it was, I mean, obviously it was a controversial thing both times, but last time the board just split on racial lines, didn't change the name. Now it from a political standpoint, they almost had to do it.
Hmm. Kyle, how did it come across on television?
I think it came across as the same way it did really in print. You had people on both sides arguing things, and both sides had some certain things wrong as well. Now the conversation, I think, is going to become about how to pay for it. Already we're seeing, especially the detractors who didn't want the name change to begin with, saying, okay, well, now how are you going to pay for it? Because it's going to cost, what is it, like $500,000 or something to change, you know, all of the stationery and the gym floor and all of this stuff, you know, the name on the outside of the high school. So now we've shifted into how are we going to pay for it? And you know, Vitti has said before that we wanted to try to get some private organizations as well to help with the money, but none of those, you know, we're just starting. And so now that's going to become the conversation, I think.
Now, there was on this show, one of the interminable times that we discussed this, a guy called in with a sign company mm-hmm. and said that he would donate a new sign. I did not write down his name. I now wish I had. But, you know, assuming that gentleman is still listening, now it's time to step up and, you know, have people put their money where their mouth were.
Jeff, you're new in town as new editor of Folio Weekly, but this story did make national headlines throughout the place. What's the view from outside?
I think as an outsider, when I was interviewing for this job and I was looking at it, the first thing I found out about Jacksonville was that there's still a high school in late 2013 that's named after the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And I think that is right now when you get these headlines that are going out all over the world, and this is a national story. That's what a lot of people are. That's what you have with Jacksonville. You see, Jacksonville. It's a school named the school. It's a city that named a school after Nathan Forrest. And I think that $400,000 or $500,000, whatever the cost of replacing the signage, I think the overarching sort of reputation cost of not doing that would have been much, much worse for the city in the long run.
Interesting. Jeff, we've got some calls here. Richard from the West Side has been holding for a few minutes. Let's hear from Richard. Richard, are you there? Good morning, Richard. All right, Richard.
Lee High School, we need to change the name of Andrew Jackson. And we also need to change the name of the city of Jacksonville also. Now that we've gone this far, I mean, why stop at the Nathan B. Forrest School? I mean, we need to change all these names. How are we going to do it?
Well, that was part of the argument here, is if we change one, we change all. We've got majority, what is now majority black school over there, Robert E. Lee on Riverside. But I guess there seemed to be some difference in the argument about the name associated with Nathan Bedford Forrest in this case. It doesn't seem to be the same, at least at this point, doesn't seem to be the same kind of furor to change your other names as it has surrounding this business with Nathan Forrest.
I think part of the difference is if you ask random, you know, person on the street, hey, who's Robert E. Lee? They know who he is. They might have an issue with the Confederacy, but at least they know who the guy was. You ask a random person on the street who, you know, Forrest was. Honestly, before this came up, he was not a... Yeah, you don't see a lot of biographies written about him. He's not required reading in high school sort of thing. So the idea of... It's almost like this guy was picked to have the school named after him for nothing to do with his own fame, where a Lee or a Jackson or people like that, they're on a different, you know, level of historical stature.
I would imagine that it had to do with the circumstances surrounding why the name was chosen in the first place, which was essentially a middle finger to the federal government to say, you know, you're not going to desegregate us. And I think, you know, that's sort of the mentality that a lot of the activists and folks in the black community looked at and said, well, you know, it's an intentional insult. And I think that's what drew a lot of the sort of ire, and I think that's probably what's kept this going for a long time.
Well, that's the idea. Tom on the West Side says the focus should be on education. Tom?
Like I was saying earlier, I think the real issue should have been all along the quality of the education students get. Forrest has been relentlessly poor for, like, forever. Whereas my personal experience, I went to Terry Parker. I have no idea who Terry Parker is, but at least I got a quality education there.
Well, that's the idea. They did get a quality education, and that's what a lot of people argue. It's about the quality of education. Unfortunately, these ideas get caught up in the issues of politics. I mean, the thing was named in 1959, from what we can gather, on the request of the Daughters of the Confederacy, and it was done as an answer to the 1954 desegregation ruling that took place in the Supreme Court. So, you know, yes, education is a major issue, but politics plays into it, and elections have consequences. What Tim mentioned before, I mean, 4 years ago, the old school board, the other school board members decided that they were going to leave it alone. The election took place. We now have 6 new board members on the place, with the exception of Paula Wright, who was on that old board, and they all voted this time unanimously. One more call on this particular issue from Foster in St. Johns County. Foster, go ahead.
Yes, I want to disagree with the panelist who said Nathan B. Forrest was unknown. I'm very glad they changed the name, because I found it insulting to have the name over there. But when Robert E. Lee was asked who his best general was, he said a man I never met, Nathan B. Forrest. So he is very well known for scandalous and infamous things that he may or may not have done, but I really am in favor of the name change.
All right, good enough. And the argument continues. We'll follow that, of course, to see what name will actually be put on to the Westside High School. Also making it out this week, a local investment firm wants to build what should be Florida's tallest building at the city's old shipyards property. The Ponte Vedra-based group Kalashi Investments proposed a 1,000-foot-tall observation tower they're calling Sea Glass Tower to the board of the Police and Fire Pension Fund last Friday. It was part of a proposal that also included a complex of other buildings, including an aquarium, restaurants, and residential property. Kalashi proposed that the fund buy the property from the city and then agree to let the firm develop it. Our question to the callers, what do you think of this proposal? Do you think this would bring residents and tourists to downtown? Give us a call at 594-2937. Tim, you're covering this beat. What are we looking at here?
It is a truly astounding rendering. And I use the word rendering because I've been, you know, covering business stuff in Jacksonville for a long time. And it's amazing the pretty pictures that people have come up with over the years. Putting that into, turning it from a picture to reality apparently costs lots and lots of money, which is hard to come by. Shockingly, the tower would basically, the idea is that we'd have something like the Arch in St. Louis or the Space Needle or, you know, pick your landmark, and that it would become something that would draw people to downtown. The argument by the developers is rather than simply have retail and have stuff like that downtown, you need something that's iconic that would bring the tourists who are passing by, have them come to Jacksonville. Quite frankly, I don't know why people go to things like the Arch in St. Louis. It's an odd sort of tourist attraction, but, you know, people do.
Well, you know, when I looked at it, I mentioned this to you guys earlier, when I looked at it, I just finished watching an episode of The Avengers, and I can swear that this thing looks a lot like Stark Tower to me, except it doesn't lean quite as much as Tony Stark's tower, the Iron Man thing.
That is a point in its favor. I mean, you know, we could attract our own superhero. Talk about putting Jacksonville on the map. I mean, you know.
Here's the thing. A lot of people argue that maybe we should be putting money into places that are already downtown, like mm-hmm. The Landing, for example, mm-hmm. rather than just building, you know, something new. And the other point about these other landmarks, and whether it be St. Louis or Seattle, is that St. Louis and Seattle, for example, are two very, very different cities. There's a lot of other stuff to mm-hmm. do in St. Louis and Seattle surrounding the Arch. You can't just build this, you know, gigantic feature and say it's really pretty and you can see the St. John's River and not have enough stuff around it and enough stuff for other people to do. And people need to feel safe in downtown. And regardless of the actual crime rates, there's a perception that downtown is unsafe.
So that's why we need a superhero.
It will be in that tower.
Touché.
Mike on the west side has a couple of words about the sea glass Stark Tower. Mike, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but I think it would be wise for Jacksonville to tell the people that want to develop this, if you want to do this, fine, but you have to link it and build it to the Skyway or that whatever that little train thing is that doesn't go anywhere. Let's get that thing. We put some money into this project. We got to do something with it. We got to start somewhere. I think that's a good thing we should bring up, though.
Well, it is something to bring up because if the tower were to be built, we've got the tower in this one place. And I'd advise everybody to drive down there. It's right across the street from the jail. You can't miss it. And then between that, you've got Berkman Plaza, you've got the courthouse, and you've got the old city hall begging for somebody to do something with it. The Berkman Plaza, too, mm-hmm. is apparently not going to be finished. It's probably apparently more money somewhere else than finishing that off. So it's we've got quite a lot to link if we're going to do this.
Well, that fits in exactly what Kyle said, right. The idea that it can't just be a one-piece thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody goes to New York to see the Empire State Building. Mm-hmm. While you're there, you see it, but you're not going to go across the country and, yay, big building. The idea is you're there for everything, and it's a piece of it. So I, for some reason, had not thought about the closeness to the jail, but that maybe that argues for your superhero theory. That
Kyle, Christopher, is this going to work for you? You go downtown a lot.
Here's the two points I want to make about this tower. Number one, if you step back and look at what the city is trying to do big picture, particularly when you take this and you also take 220 Riverside, the larger plan is to try to get more people to not only visit and patronize downtown, but live there. And I think I think to have 220 Riverside, which is right there in Brooklyn, and then to try to have some residential things in this sea glass tower is a few specks of the city's larger plan to try to get people to live down there. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how much the fund and the mayor and the city should be willing to go on board with this when it was presented Friday and they had no financial structure.
That's going to be the key question. This is being proposed to the pension fund, who's already got a $1.7 million, $1 billion gap.
And if there's no plan to sort of see how the fund and how the city would benefit from this. It's great to have this great tower with an aquarium and all this other stuff, but it puts a fund that you said that's already in trouble in deeper hot water.
So. It was actually interesting that it was presented to the pension fund. That's not where you typically see these sort of things pop up. But the idea was basically the fund makes its returns by investing in things, and it would invest in this the way that it's invested in other properties that it's picked up, you know, like any other property developer. but that issue of, okay, so the fund would buy the property from the city, and the city has to give the fund millions of dollars for the, it's just too confusing, basically.
Well, you can still give us a call, folks, and join in on the Friday Media Roundtable at 549-2937. We've got Marie in Jacksonville, who's been holding for quite some time. She has a couple of words on the Nathan Bedford Forrest story. Marie, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here, hon.
Go ahead.
I think that they should leave the names alone. There's more important things that our limited funds could be spent on. Now, the Forrest guy, he was a KKK member, but later in his life, he saw the light. And he changed his ways for the better. There's good and bad in all of us. And these controversial names can spark a light of positive change without spending money to change the names. And, you know, people can have discussions, but names are names. And I don't think we have to change them just, you know, spend money. I mean, you change that, it starts a whole, you know, I mean, look at the person, discuss it, and if you like it, you do, if you don't, you don't, but that's it, you know? I mean, accept people. There's good and bad in all of us, you know? And some people change and some don't, but, you know, a name's a name. It's been there, and it's not hurting anybody, you know?
Well,
the teacher should help the kids just understand the history, you know?
Point well taken, Marie. Thank you for calling us this morning. The number to dial is 549-2937 if you'd like to join in our media roundtable. Well, we wanted to mention briefly in education news that the Department of Education released preliminary 2013 grades to high schools this week, and 9 schools in Duval County earned an A rating this year. That's up from the last 7. Superintendent Nikolai Vitti says that 71% of Duval's public schools have earned either an A or a B this year, the most in district history. He says it's a sign that there is hard work going on throughout the county. Christopher Brooks, again, you've covered this story for the Times Union. How are these grades determined, and how is Northeast Florida faring in relation to the rest of the state?
Let me take those answers in two parts. So for the grade calculation, you know, it's, in some way it's complex, but it's when you look at all the components that go into making the grade, it makes sense. So half of the grade of a high school comes from how those students do on their FCAT, right? I mean, the standardized test there. But then the other 50% comes from other things that you feel like a high school should have done well, like its graduation rate, how well it does on end-of-course exams, how good students are doing on sort of college advanced programs like dual enrollment or advanced placement. So all these other things factor into it, as well as how well your at-risk students are doing. And each of those little factors have a percentage in the entire formula. But that's some of the things that go into how well your school does. And you can get a total of 1,600 points. You get to 1,600, you get an A. So anything further down from that, B, C, you know, other than that. But, and then also for, I mean, in relation to how our region is doing compared to the rest of the state, there is an improvement. I mean, we're not at the top, but you can see a marked improvement for where Duval is doing. St. John's has always been at the top of grades across the state, not only in the elementary and middle school level, but also what we saw this week in high schools as well. You know, I know that the superintendent wants to get a lot higher. He talks a lot about comparing this district with some of our other urban districts in the state, Miami and Hillsborough and Broward and stuff like that. He hasn't surpassed some of those counties yet. When you look at those big 6, those big 7, but he's climbing. He's climbing, and I know that his aspirations is to get up higher than those other counties. So.
Kyle, how is this viewed on the visual side? These kinds of stories having to do with there are not a lot of numbers involved, but there's still people behind the story and students behind the story. How's it viewed from your end?
Well, right, and that's really what we want to focus on. And regardless of whether or not it's a visual story, education is still a priority, I think, you know, in our community. We've realized that education is a priority. It always has been. Even the JAX 2025 survey, for example, you know, education was this huge priority. So you know, our goal as far as the TV question is basically to make it as simple yet accurate for the viewers to understand. What we see a lot, and what a lot of my friends and stuff who have who have families, they focus, some of them move to St. John's County strictly for the schools. They want to move out of Duval County just for the schools. And when we talk about things like the shipyards and why people are living in Jacksonville, you know, education is actually something that, that really, really, really needs to be improved, more so than a gigantic tower. So I think that on TV, what we get is a lot of conversation about, you know, this should be the focus. Education should be the focus.
Well, we've got one more caller on the forest issue. Mike from the South Side has been holding for a bit. Mike, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Well, my take on it is any time we're going to name a school or a public government-run facility after another person, it could always come to light that, well, that person wasn't exactly perfect. I don't think we could name them after a president. If we named it after Ulysses S. Grant, I'm sure we'd come up with plenty of issues of why that's not a good name. So my philosophy or my input would be don't name them after anybody. Remove all names off the schools. Name them using a number system or some other kind of system like we see done in other municipalities, and remove all the controversy.
That is actually the school board's policy right now, to no longer name schools after people. The last couple of schools in this district that have been erected out at the beaches are Atlantic Coast and First Coast, and that's why they're named that way and not necessarily as a person. So that's a great point, caller, and that's actually in play right now.
And
so.
Dr. Vitti actually made that point with this. You know, I mean, we've actually on this panel in the past discussed names and what sort of thing, but he said, you know, this will not have a name. You know, this will not have a person's name. You know, it'll be West Side or Firestone or something like that, just for that very reason.
Because interesting. The big push was name it after Spiker. And,
right.
And honestly, that seemed to be the common wisdom that that could get the community behind
it.
That
was a cruel irony of this whole situation, that both sides would have been okay with Spiker. And then we can't name it after a person.
Well, that's
start a petition.
It's going to be one or two going forward. Now, since this is our last show and last media roundtable of the year, we thought it would take a little time to discuss some of the top stories of 2013. We've come up with a list of what we think were the biggest stories of the year. We may not be able to cover all of them this morning, but we wanted to take a look at least a few. What do you think are the biggest stories of the year? Let us know at 549-2937. And we'll start in no particular order with one of the earliest stories of the year, the investigation into the group allied veterans of the world and its internet cafes. The IRS and the U.S. Secret Service worked with the state and local agencies to uncover what they say was a racketeering and illegal gambling operation run by the heads of the group. While Allied Veterans said it was donating 70% or more of its proceeds to charity, authorities found that only about 2% were actually going to veterans' causes. Investigators also said the internet cafes run by Allied Veterans were really internet casinos that violated Florida's gambling laws. Among the local figures arrested in the case were Jacksonville attorney Kelly Mathis, who was the first to be tried in the case, and was found guilty in October of running the illegal gambling operation. Jacksonville Fraternal Order of Police President Nelson Cuba was also arrested as part of the investigation, and the investigation had effects in Tallahassee as well. It led to Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll, who has done some consulting with Allied Veterans in the past, to resign from her post, and that post has still not been filled yet. So, gentlemen, what are the top stories? Allied Veterans is there. We've got a couple of others we can look at. What do we think about this? Did that make your top 10 list for the year?
It makes my top 10 list. And to me, the great irony of the Allied Veteran story, which I covered extensively when I was with the Times Union, and you drive around now and these are popping up again. Mm-hmm. And it kind of astounds me thinking of the press conferences that the IRS and the state had just demonizing these internet cafe operators who arguably said they were trying to basically walk up to the edge of the law and not violate it. And now they're popping back up, and now you can buy, $500 million lottery tickets. And, now we're talking about casino gambling. It's, ironic.
I think that the approach that states and municipalities often take toward gambling, it's almost a little bit schizophrenic. They can't decide whether this is going to be the great thing that saves us and is our next revenue stream, or it's the devil's greatest trick, or whatever it may be. And I think it's just bizarre to me that we can't I don't know, that there was this much furor over, you know, people gambling on computers in little strip malls and across the state. And I guess, you know, they say that gambling is a tax on the stupid, but...
Well, it wasn't so much that they were gambling. We have legal gambling going on all the time. We have Hi-Li in South Florida. We've had dog racing until it turned bad here the last few years. There's not enough money in dog racing.
Right.
And of course, we've got a huge card game going on the west side in Arlington right now. So it's not the gambling. It's what the law says.
The other thing is Jacksonville is a huge military town. And whenever you have any story about, like, people in the military not getting not just what they deserve, but you know, people say they're giving this money.
They were promised this money
and all of this stuff. And when you have the idea of veterans getting bilked for anything or anything negative at all happening to the military community in Jacksonville, it's not going to be pretty. And that was a huge, huge part of the story, more so than I think the gambling even was.
It's one of the odd bits of that story was the idea that being a charity was not intrinsic to what they did. There are non-allied veteran internet cafes that were doing the exact same thing, and they got shut down because of the gambling. But you're right, the headlines were, this is a group that says we're doing this to raise money for vets, and we'll give you some money, but we're making so much that tossing you a couple bucks isn't, you know, it's rounding error.
One of the other big stories of the year, of course, is Stand Your Ground. Bill on the South Side has a few words about that. I think that's tied to the George Zimmerman verdict as well as possibly the Marissa Alexander case. Bill on the South Side, welcome to First Coast Connect.
Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I would put both cases in this category, and a future case hasn't even been tried yet, but you know, that word has become common, you know, in our vocabulary. And 2 years ago, nobody even knew what it was or heard it. I've got children, and, you know, I got a formula that says, well, we've got low education, we've got plenty of guns, and the outcome can only be bad. So that's just basically what I've got to say. I mean, these kind of things can only happen when people suspect decision making can go on, and with adding in all the weapons.
Thank you for calling, Bill. I mean, he's got a point. The George Zimmerman verdict, the Marissa Alexander case, and we've got probably another one that's going to Michael Dunn case. All have one particular thing tied with them, and that's our state attorney's office. Is tied with all of these cases. Two of them, of course, Marissa Alexander and the Zimmerman case, of course, made nationwide, if not worldwide, news. How does this fit on your list of top stories for the year, Kyle?
I think they all were definitely top stories. I think many people in the nation would argue the George Zimmerman case, and specifically the verdict that a lot of people didn't expect would be one of the top stories even in the country. And that's the other point I'd like to make about our little list of local and statewide stories that, you know, are the top in, you know, Jacksonville and the state. Some of these stories, if not a majority of them, have made national news. I mean, Marissa Alexander, George Zimmerman, Michael Dunn. Michael Dunn will make more headlines as it goes. Cherish Periwinkle is another we haven't gotten to yet. All of these stories, unfortunately for the city of Jacksonville and the state, are making major national news or have already made it. The other point I'd like to make about these stories is that for the most part, they're probably going to be top stories in 2014 as well. Maybe not George Zimmerman, but every time the word Zimmerman happens, we do a story on it. So his name will still be in the media. Michael Dunn isn't going to happen until 2014. Marissa Alexander has more to come in 2014, as does, of course, Donald Smith and the Cherish Periwinkle case. So we're going to be discussing these stories all next year, and we're probably going to be sitting at this roundtable a year from now talking about the top stories, and it's going to be the same.
Well, one of the tragic stories of the year is Cherish Periwinkle. It's tragic in that it happened to a young girl, but equally tragic with this case is that her sisters have been taken away from the mother at one point. They're trying to get them back. And, of course, we have this guy on the other hand, who's accused of kidnapping her and apparently accused of murdering her, and he's even willing to go to the electric chair to pay for his crime. This made, I think, sort of number two on the list for us this year. What's your feeling about this? Jeff, you're just coming in.
Well, I mean, it's certainly a tragedy, and I didn't. I will confess that I didn't follow it too closely. I think I was living in Orlando or Philly when that went down. So I don't want to offer too much, but yet, you know, what I do know about the case is, you know, tragic and sad. And I know that there's a big move right now in Tallahassee to, I guess, make the, what was the word, scorched earth for, you know, sort of predators and sexual predators, things like that. And then something the legislature is going to take up next year. And sometimes you can, I don't know.
Well, the number if you've got a couple of words on this, the number is 549-2937. If you've got a couple of words on our top stories of the year, Christopher?
It was almost like a double tragedy because, you know, when Cherish fell and there was always talks of her sisters being taken away from her mom, there was a lot of headlines recently after that where she was trying to explain to the public that she is a good mother, and that just didn't, that plea didn't go well for her because they eventually took her daughters anyway. So, you know, her other daughters aren't, you know, haven't died, but she's lost all of them in a very short time.
Here's the thing about Cherish Periwinkle. I mean, it's tragic, but it's more tragic if we don't learn from it, I think. And I think a lot of people say that. And this unveiled so many issues, whether they're systemic issues with how families are handled in the state of Florida, whether it's issues with how sex offenders are handled in the state of Florida, whether it's issues with how the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office handles the media and notifying the media when a child disappears, for example. There are numerous things that this case uncovered. Things have already changed, specifically regarding how JSO lets us know about any sort of missing or endangered child. I know since then we've had I don't want to say a ton, but we've had numerous false alarms that may not have necessarily made it, you know, had it not been for this case and the repercussions after this case. And that's just one part of it.
I understand. Bill from Mandarin's been holding for a bit. He has a couple of words on one other story that made our top 10 list. That's a fire pension fund. Bill?
Yeah, happy holidays, everybody.
Thank you.
I think the biggest rock turned over has been the mayor's appointment of that commission to check out the police and fire defense fund. One calculation has it they may have to raise taxes 13% just to meet our obligation. That is an honest obligation. I'll leave it at that for right now.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Appreciate you calling. And again, thanks to our last media panel of the year, Jeff Billman, Chris Brooks, and Kyle Sieg are with us, along with my good friend, who I can always mess up his name, Tim Gibbons from the Jacksonville Business Journal. Again, thank you for joining us, gentlemen. Have a happy, a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.